If the CalCERFI contracts that we presented to the commission had been approved, we would not have this situation.
Lawmakers hear about a potential serious shortage of gas for hundreds of customers. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 25th of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, environmentalists write up policy recommendations for the incoming Obama administration.
Certainly the Arctic has been front and center on the sort of assault that we saw from the Bush administration on the environment.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Anchorage's natural gas utility, NSTAR, has until Monday to finish negotiating a contract with Cook Inlet producers if they want to avoid a gas shutdown to about 400 businesses who have been cut off from their previous supplier. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports that the State Senate Judiciary Committee this morning heard about the problem.
The Anchorage businesses got their first glimpse of a pending problem when Aurora Power notified them that under their existing service contracts, their natural gas service would be cut off on December 1st, and it recommended they contact NSTAR for future fuel. NSTAR followed up with its own letter on November 10th, saying that company could take on the businesses, but only for a month. On January 1st, they'd be cut off from them, too. Mike Gordon has been managing Chilkoot Charlie's in Spinard for 39 years, and he told the Judiciary Committee that he thought he had seen all the adversity possible, but now he can't stay in business without gas.
You ever feel like you're between a rock and a hard spot? There's an old saying in Africa about how when elephants fight, only the grass gets trampled. And that's kind of where I feel I am.
And Tom Tiber manages several hundred employees in the 50,000-square-foot Northwest Airlines cargo facility at the Anchorage Airport. He says those elephants Gordon referred to are using the 400 businesses in a fight between Cook Inlet gas producers ConocoPhillips and Marathon and the Regulatory Commission of Alaska over the price of gas. And Tiber says the consensus of the businesses represented at the hearing indicates that without a supply of gas, they can't keep the doors open.
My sense of it is it almost feels a little bit like we're being played to a certain degree. I feel the elephants are almost playing us to come here and testify and push this agenda for them.
NSTAR representatives say they have no choice. They don't have a guaranteed source of gas for 400 more commercial customers. There's plenty of gas. That's not the problem. And they say they've negotiated a contract to buy enough of it. But the Regulatory Commission of Alaska turned it down. The RCA wanted NSTAR, which it regulates, to go back to the gas producers, which it does not regulate, with a new price formula. Dan Dickgraff, NSTAR's manager of rates and regulatory affairs, sides with the customers. Although RCA has approved contracts similar to what's now been rejected, he told the committee that the difference is the new formula RCA wants to try would lower prices by about 15%.
If the CalCERFI contracts that we presented to the commission had been approved, we would not have this situation. We feel like we are stuck between the producers and the commission's two separate desires on pricing, just like these customers are.
ConocoPhillips says the RCA's late position in the negotiations points out its own inconsistencies. The commission has previously accepted the formula that was used in the stalled contract, and Vice President Eric Isaacson says the company had no interest in spending 22 months developing a contract that would be disapproved.
Mr. Chairman, you know what the Cook Inlet needs now for its long-term health is more activity, not less. How many independents do you see actively exploring or developing gas in the Cook Inlet today? To attract this activity and in order to keep the Cook Inlet alive into the future, we need to have a transparent pricing mechanism that allows a fair market price for the investment in this basin, in the Cook Inlet Basin.
Since they're sitting as judges on the rate issue, members of the Regulatory Commission did not testify. However, state attorneys say the new formula is based on prices in other U.S. gas basins, and companies could expect the same returns. The issue comes down to Monday, when NSTAR must give the commission the results of its new negotiations with the producers. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
A group of about 30 environmental and wildlife agencies have delivered a policy recommendation paper to President-elect Barack Obama's transition team. It lays out their united environmental and energy policy goals and features the Arctic as a major concern. APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington.
The nearly 400-page report outlines the goals of environmentalists and wildlife advocates ranging from the Wilderness Society to the Union of Concerned Scientists and the Native American Rights Fund. The groups acknowledge that the Obama administration's first goal will be tackling the current economic crisis. But Larry Schweiger, president of the National Wildlife Federation, says that is compatible with focusing on environmental policy.
As we all know, our economy is suffering, and so is our environment. The solutions to both challenges go hand in hand. I believe what we need now to do is to dig our way out of the financial hole we're in with a green shovel.
Schweiger and his colleagues argue that investing in energy efficiencies and renewables can help stabilize the economy. They say a cap-and-trade system, which would reduce carbon dioxide emissions, could generate funds to spur more investments in clean energy. The president of the Natural Resources Defense Council, Francis Beinecke, says the future lies in green-collar jobs.
Environmentalists of all stripes have united around a singular idea. We could solve three problems with one solution. By investing in efficiency and clean renewable energy sources now, we can cut our addiction to oil, reduce global warming pollution, and restart our economic engine.
The new report, called Transition to Green, was presented to the Obama transition team on Monday. It breaks down goals into categories and highlights areas of particular concern, including the Arctic. Christy Goldfuss works for the group Environment America as a preservation advocate. She says the new administration should focus on creating a direction for the Arctic in their first 100 days.
The Green Group as a whole and everyone who's working on these policies nationally sees the Arctic as one of the key areas that we need to address right away going forward, some of which needs to fix the problems that we've seen from the past 8 years and then really develop a new policy that addresses the unique area of the Arctic.
Goldfuss says the first step will be crafting a new comprehensive Arctic plan. She says despite the current focus on economics, she expects the new administration to tackle climate change and its effects on the far north.
They're serious about that. I mean, in all the conversations that we're having with them, change was not just a slogan. That's really where they're focused. And certainly the Arctic has been front and center on the sort of assault that we saw from the Bush administration on the environment.
Goldfuss wants to see a cautionary approach to any new industrial activity in the Arctic, including exploration for natural gas hydrates, new oil and gas leasing, and offshore development. The report talks about working on environmental issues not just with the executive branch, but with legislators. Alaska's sending its first Democrat to Washington in nearly 30 years, but Senator-elect Mark Begich is in favor of drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and has warned that he will vote his own way on environmental issues, striking a balance with development. Goldfuss says her organization is at this point learning about Begich, but they're happy to have him in office.
We're just in conversations and getting to know him and really finding out where he is on all these different policies. So exactly how that's going to fit into our broader goals, we don't know quite yet.
Governor Sarah Palin's spokesman, Bill McAllister, says there are some things in the Transition to Green report the governor's office agrees with, having healthy oceans and strong, viable fisheries. However, McAllister says much of the report echoes the regular drumbeat of environmentalists fighting development in the Arctic.
The report really contains nothing new. These are goals of environmentalists for some time now, and the differences between many in the environmental community and the state of Alaska are well documented, and we don't really see any point in making an issue of those differences right now.
McAllister says Governor Palin's office is also invested in seeing how the Obama administration proceeds over the next few weeks as the president-elect makes his appointments to key posts in departments that greatly affect Alaska, like the Interior Department and Commerce.
What is much more fruitful is waiting to see the various officials that are appointed that will affect Alaska and these areas, and then working with them to find agreement and to make our case.
McAllister says, just like the environmentalists, Governor Palin plans to make her pitch to the new administration. Her message may run counter to theirs in some respects. She believes energy development in Alaska can help the national economy. And Governor Palin may have an opportunity to offer her opinion next week. She plans to attend a gathering in Philadelphia, where President-elect Obama will meet with the nation's governors. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
The final numbers are in, and this time State Representative Mike Kelly really is one vote ahead of his rival. Kelly, a Fairbanks Republican, has an unofficial total of 5,018 votes after overseas ballots for House District 7 were counted today. Democratic challenger Carl Castle has 5,017 votes. Officials say Election Day votes were miscounted in two of the district's precincts. Elections Division Director Gail Fanumiai says the discrepancy was later discovered and corrected. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Yukon Quest is shaping up to be one of the biggest in years.
Certainly if you look in the over the past 10 years or so, you know, numbers have been in the 20s, so this is significantly higher, which is great to see.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, a proud supporter of cultural activities that enrich the lives of all Alaskans. Wells Fargo, the next stage. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The Alaska Commission on Judicial Conduct recommends suspending Bethel Judge Dennis Cummings from the bench for ethical violations. That's a sanction that they've never asked for before. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
The Conduct Commission released its opinion late Monday, which recommends that Cummings is suspended from the bench and that he gets training before returning. Their recommendation now goes to the Alaska Supreme Court, which will decide what to do next. The commission's written opinion states that Cummings' actions were, quote, significant violations. The commission held a hearing last week in Anchorage and found that Cummings had contact with one side of a trial and not the other, or what's called ex parte contact, and he failed to avoid the appearance of impropriety. Cummings has been a district court judge in Bethel for nearly 3 years. In a trial in March, Cummings passed a note to an Alaska state trooper who was a witness in the case and the judge's friend. The note contained evidence about the trial. And the next day in court, Cummings passed a second note addressed to the trooper and the prosecutor. The commission also heard from a witness who said Cummings passed a note in a previous trial, although no action was taken then. The commission's vote was not unanimous, however. 6 of the 8 seated commissioners recommended the suspension. The other 2 wrote up a separate opinion that disagrees with the majority only on the sanction or the punishment. The 2 agreed with Cummings' attorney on one detail.
That suspension was not allowed under the statute.
Marla Greenstein is the executive director of the commission. She says during the hearing, the judge's attorney argued that the legislature has not given the commission the authority to suspend judges. She says 2 members of the commission agreed and are asking for a harsher punishment, that Cummings be removed from the bench permanently.
But if suspension is allowed under the statute and they're mistaken, they would go with the majority recommendation of suspension.
The opinion states that Cummings has had no prior disciplinary record and that his motives were not dishonest or selfish. Cummings has 30 days to petition the court to reject the commission's recommendation. His attorney, John Kacher of Anchorage, says he hasn't decided whether or not to do that. Kacher did not want to comment further on the case. No Alaskan judge has ever been suspended or removed from the bench before. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
The field for the Yukon Quest is shaping up to be one of the largest and most competitive in recent years. 32 teams are registered for the 26th running of the 1,000-mile event. Race director Tanya Simpson says recent additions include top mushers from across the border.
Over the last week, we've had 2 new entries from Canada's well-known mushers. We've had Hans Gott enter as well as Sebastian Schnell. So it's very exciting to see those mushers come into the pool.
Shnula placed seventh in his last quest in 2007. Gott also last competed in the quest in 2007, finishing second. The three-time quest winner joins two other past champions in this year's field, the race's first winner, Sonny Lindner, and reigning four-time champ, Lance Mackey. The roster also includes Martin Boozer, a four-time Iditarod winner who will be a rookie in the quest. Last year, only 24 teams started the quest, and in 2007, just 21 participated. Simpson says this year's field harkens back to the old days when the quest routinely attracted more mushers.
If you look back, I mean, historically, 1989, we had 47 mushers that started the race, and that matched 1988, which was the largest we've had in the history of the Yukon Quest. But certainly, if you look in the over the past 10 years or so, you know, numbers have been in the 20s, so this is significantly higher, which is great to see.
The last time the race had this many entries was 2003. Simpson is optimistic the field could grow even larger before February's start. The regular entry fee deadline for the race is December 12th. After that, the cost jumps from $1,500 to $2,000. The maximum number of teams allowed in the 1,000-mile event is 50. The race starts February 14th, the last time it will begin mid-month. Beginning in 2010, the quest will move up a week to accommodate the increasing number of mushers competing in both the quest and the Iditarod.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Engineering News Fund, whose contributors include Dowell HKM, providing civil and transportation engineering, land surveying, and planning services, on the web at dowellhkm.com.
The campus of the former Sheldon Jackson College in Sitka has made the list of the state's 12 most endangered historic properties. The designation came just ahead of a recent decision by the Sitka Planning Commission to approve a new plat for the campus that leaves most of the National Historic Landmark intact. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Since closing its doors suddenly in the summer of 2007, Sheldon Jackson College has been in the hands of a couple of property management firms, most recently Pacific Tower Properties, or PTP. Several campus buildings have been rented by local nonprofits for a child care center and an aquatic science lab, among other things, but the rest of the college's property has been prepared for sale to satisfy the school's roughly $13 million of debt. The Sitka Planning Commission on November 18th gave final approval to a plat that subdivides most of the college's perimeter properties, including the PE Center and former faculty housing, but leaves intact the 19th century quadrangle and the nearby modern student center and dormitories. Sitka Planning Director Wells Williams confirms that there were negotiations with the college over the boundaries of the contiguous parcel, but the intent to preserve the campus came from the trustees.
Pacific Tower SJ how much of the core campus was going to be maintained. That came directly from Sheldon Jackson and or through Pacific Tower.
Williams says the commission essentially approved the plat as presented by the college's property management firm, leaving the quadrangle and associated buildings like the President's House on a single piece of property preserves the possibility that the college may have some future institutional use, but it doesn't preserve the buildings themselves. The Historic American Building Survey describes the distinctive architectural style of the quad as Tudor eclectic. The campus earned National Historic Landmark status in 2001. Williams says the Planning Commission will try to address preservation issues soon.
There is a commitment on the part of the Planning Commission later on in the spring to see if there's some way to put some language in a public process to talk about protecting the exterior of those structures and maybe some of the yard.
Assurances that something may be done to protect the campus are not enough for the Alaska Association of Historic Preservation. Like the National Trust for Historic Preservation, which publishes its top 11 endangered places for the country, the AAHP publishes its top 12 for the state. Sheldon Jackson College has been on the list before. A decade ago, the college nearly condemned its central building, the Allen Auditorium, before a citizen committee nominated the campus for landmark status and saved Allen. And non-SJ properties like the Japonsky Island Boathouse have recently been on the list. until the Sitka Maritime Heritage Society began active restoration work. Renee Erickson, the administrator of the Alaska Association for Historic Preservation, says a state endangered listing is not necessarily permanent.
Like, for example, the boathouse is no longer on the list because of the efforts that were made with it. And then last year we had the post office in Soldotna had been on our list for a while, and then the preservation efforts that were made to secure that building allowed it to be no longer considered a threat.
Other endangered properties on the AAHP list this year include the 4th Avenue Theater in Anchorage, Clover Pass in Ketchikan, the Jesse Lee Home in Seward, and the Cape St. Elias Lighthouse. Landmark status is not required for properties to make the endangered list. Erickson says anyone across the state can nominate a property, and then the AAHP board will vote on the nominations. Still, the fact that Shelton Jackson is a national landmark is unusual. Daily Sitka Sentinel editor Thad Polson was instrumental in obtaining landmark status for the campus. Reached for comment on the endangered listing, Polson said Shelton Jackson is in a category by itself. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
The Inter-Island Ferry Authority is now taking reservations online. Tickets can be booked and paid for through the authority's website, interislandferry.com. Marketing manager Len Lawrence says the IFA hopes the system will increase ridership.
People can go online and access the reservation system and find out the exact status of space on board, particularly car deck space, because it's not unusual for sailings to be completely sold out. So with the reservation system, people can check any time of the night or day as far as space is concerned.
The IFA operates two ferries based on Prince of Wales Island. The Stikine sails from Hollis to Ketchikan and back on a daily basis, except for Thanksgiving and Christmas. The Prince of Wales sails from Kaufman Cove to Wrangell in Petersburg and back 3 days a week during the summer. One way to determine the approximate age of a bowhead whale is by looking at changes in their eye lenses. This, combined with other methods, can help scientists tell how the whales are doing and what kinds of environmental changes may be affecting them over the course of the bowhead's life. Sitka High School students recently had a chance to play scientist and do their own eyeball dissections as part of the Sitka Whale Fest Science in the Schools program. KCAW's Bonnie Sue Hitchcock reports.
Cheryl Rosa works for the North Slope Borough assessing the health status of bowhead whales. And because there is a subsistence whale harvest every year on the North Slope, Rosa is able to conduct her research fairly easily.
We go to these whales as they're being butchered, and we take little pieces of all of the organs, and I look at them under the microscope. It's called histology, and I want to make sure that the tissues look normal, that we don't see any evidence of pathology, because that can tell me that there's something going on. If I see it in one animal, it's interesting. If I see it in 10 animals, then I start to get worried. I start thinking, maybe we've got something going on here.
Rosa is addressing Kent Bovee's science class at Sitka High, and she's explaining why it's so important to know how old an animal is when conducting health assessments. One example of this is contaminants and exposure to them over time.
Toxins are out there. There's all sorts of different ways toxins get into the environment, but especially toxins that accumulate, especially in fat, over time, because bowheads especially have tons of fat in their blubber. There are certain things that we look for that over the life of the animal, they build up, and it sticks around. So a two-year-old has only had 2 years exposure to PCBs in the environment, whereas a 150-year-old bowhead whale has been around a lot longer and has had much more exposure.
Another scientist from Gustavus, Chris Gabriel, studies humpback whales in southeast Alaska. One of the methods for aging humpbacks is by reading their earplugs, which she says is a lot like reading tree rings.
You can take that 6-inch earplug from a whale, very carefully slice it long ways, and then polish that edge, and then find an expert who's really good at counting these things, because it's very tricky.
Gabriel says she's here to learn from Rosa how to do eyeball dissection of humpbacks the way they do with bowheads. She says it's never been done before, mainly because there isn't a humpback whale harvest, so it's not as easy to collect enough data. But because determining age is so important, they would like to be able to use this method as well on humpbacks. Conversely, Rosa says a bowhead's earplugs are totally different from those of a humpback whale.
They're not woody, they're more like axle grease. So we don't think that we're going to be able to age them that way, but we're looking at it again. The knowledge that's been passed down over the last few decades is you can't age bowheads by looking at their earplugs. But we're going to try again.
But today the focus is on eyeballs.
We're going to have you get in pairs, and we've got 11 eyes to give out. Before we cut into them, I want you guys to look at the front of the eye and basically identify, I want you to identify where the pupil is, where the iris is, where the ciliary processes
are. The big chunks that are handed out look more like hearts, and they're fatty and smell like fish. Justine Webb and Katie McAdams struggle with their dull scalpel and just the general gross factor, but they have help from scientist Steve Lewis.
I'm just really freaked out by it, and Katie's freaked out by it.
It's not that bad.
It smells so bad.
It does not smell.
Is this supposed to come off?
It's squeezing juice. It's squeezing juice.
Cut it way at the edge. But you want to slice and then fold that whole thing back.
There you go. You're getting it.
Just think it's like cutting a steak.
Yeah, just like cutting a steak.
It's dead.
But once Rosa starts pointing out specifics about the eyes, the kids seem to forget about the smell and the slime.
That's the nerve. That's nerve tissue. So they just cut right through it. You see how different that looks from the tissue surrounding it? That's the optic nerve. It's one of the thickest optic nerves that I've seen in mammals. So big eye, big nerves, big animal. Right there. And that carries all of the neurological information that comes into the eye to the brain. That's cut. You don't see anything. Even if it's stretched, if you get a lot of trauma to your eye, that's really cool. On the other side, is that the tapetum that you guys peeled off?
There was so much gagging that it seemed like just a matter of time before someone actually threw up. I asked Rosa if that was a normal reaction, but she says she's never done eyeball dissections with students before, although during this visit, there were multiple classes that participated.
Two people gagged, and that's the first time it's happened in all five classes, so that's good. We did have someone cut themselves, which kind of made me feel bad, but one casualty for five classes, that's pretty good, I guess.
Rosa says the eyeballs these kids are dissecting are not critical because these bowheads are also aged using the baleen method, which can analyze the carbon signatures for each year of the bowhead's life. But if the eyeballs that the kids extracted aren't damaged and are able to be analyzed, so much the better. And the kids who didn't think it was too gross might consider a career down the road in science.
It's not as bad as I thought, though.
I'm doing all the work.
Which Rosa says was really the point of doing eyeball dissections in the classroom anyway. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Robert Woolsey and Bonnie Sue Hitchcock in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Dave Waldron is our audio engineer. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Conservation Solutions, providing ways to measure your carbon footprint and reduce your energy consumption at AlaskaConservationSolutions.com. And by
the Anchorage Convention and Visitors Bureau. Anchorage is wild about winter. You can find winter event information and plan your next Anchorage adventure online at anchorage.net/stay.
Miss our newscast today? Listen to APRN's Alaska Morning News, Economic Report, and News Nightly on the web at APRN.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.